You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. You may remember that back in 2015, a spacecraft called New Horizons sped past Pluto. The tiny body discovered back in the 1930s, now classed as a dwarf planet, out-orbiting billions of kilometres away from the Earth, now known to be one of a number of objects way out there in something called the Kuiper Belt. And we'll come on to what that is in a second. It's made other discoveries as well. It visited other objects. It flew past a tiny object called Arrokoth, which was a very odd sort of snowman-shaped object, and then also has made new observations of a couple of interesting objects, which is what we'll start off with today, before moving on to the latest mission to launch, the Lucy mission out to the asteroid belts, including to some Trojan asteroids. And we'll discuss what they are as well. Now, to join me in this exploration of tiny objects out in the solar system, I'm joined by Dr. James Robinson from the University of Edinburgh, who's worked on the formation of objects out in the outer solar system and how what they tell us about how our own solar system has evolved. So, James, welcome to the programme.
Yeah. Hi, Chris. Thanks very much for having me.
Now, let's start off with these objects out in the outer solar system, like in the Kuiper Belt. Now, I've called it the Kuiper Belt. People are possibly familiar with the asteroid belt, this collection of tiny objects, or much smaller objects generally, than the planets, orbiting between Mars and Jupiter. So two to four times the distance of the Earth from the Sun, so a good few hundred million kilometres. The Kuiper Belt, it's sometimes thought of as a similar kind of thing. It's a belt, it's a ring of small objects way out beyond Neptune in the outer solar system. But is that fair? Is it fair to think that it's just a sort of a further out version of the asteroid belt, or is it a bit more complicated than that?
Well, yeah, it's very interesting because it is similar to the asteroid belt in the inner solar system. It's like an outer solar system equivalent. And yeah, where the asteroid belt is more sort of rocky materials, in the Kuiper Belt, you're starting to get into more volatile and icy materials. But it spans a much greater range of distance. The inner asteroid belt is confined to the small region between Mars and Jupiter, but the Kuiper Belt goes from just outside Neptune to sort of almost hundreds of AU. In a nice, diffuse, very dynamically intricate structure. And that's the interesting thing about it, is that there's all this like fine detail in how the orbits of those icy objects are arranged that can tell us a whole lot about the history of the solar system. For example, how the planets would have migrated and stuff like that.
The asteroid belt is there because of Jupiter, as I understand it, that Jupiter's gravitational pull meant it was hard for a planet to form. And it's one of the favoured theories about why the asteroid belt is there. So it prevented planets forming at that distance from the Sun. It kept pulling apart anything that tried to form. Is the Kuiper Belt similar? Was there something just stopping stuff forming out there?
Well, so the Kuiper Belt is the remnants of the sort of protoplanetary disk that the planets and then all the other asteroids and comets formed out of. There's a whole bunch of different theories about why these small body populations exist where they are today. But for example, one of them that seems to be doing a fairly good job of explaining what we see is a model called the Nice model, named after the town in France where it was developed. But in the Nice model, it proposes that a whole load of planetesimals formed, well, first of all, the planets themselves started in a much more compact configuration. So they weren't on the orbits that they're on today. They're much closer together. And then the planetesimals formed just outside those compact planets. So about 20 to 30 AU, or astronomical units, from the Sun. And then what happened is the planets in that compact configuration, they evolved and interacted with each other and then underwent an instability, which sort of excited their orbits, scattered them out, and then scattered those planetesimals out as well. So the Kuiper Belt that we see, which is beyond 30 AU now, it's all the planetesimals that have been moved from that original formation region onto their current orbits that we observe today.
You talked about planetesimals. What do we mean by planetesimal? What are we talking about there?
A planetesimal in the early days of the solar system is just sort of any collection of solid material, basically. And it's the planetesimals that then collide and grow to form a small number of protoplanets, which then collide and grow further to form the large planets that we see today. But whenever we like jump forward to the modern solar system, we're sort of left with this nice simple picture of terrestrial planets, giant planets, and then asteroids and comets. And you sort of think, oh, two distinct populations. But at the end of the day, asteroids and comets, they all evolved from these early planetesimals. And then depending on where those planetesimals formed in the disk, if they formed closer to the sun, they might be more rocky and then evolved into where we see the asteroid belt today. Or if they evolved, or if they were formed further out in the disk, they might have more ices and volatiles. And then whenever they were scattered outwards, that's where we see them today in the Kuiper belt. And then the interesting thing is the transition between asteroids and comets, where something that was residing in the outer solar system, whenever it comes closer to the sun, it heats up and the ices sublimate, and it gives off this this mass loss and activity. And that's what we see as a comet. But if it's stuck out in the outer solar system where it's not getting heated, it's still technically got that asteroid designation. So the planetesimals is sort of at the early stage of the solar system, this catch-all term.
And as you say, this whole we talk about asteroids and comets, but it's all, there's a lot of grey areas in between, or maybe it's actually one big grey area of what these things are and how we distinguish between them in their evolution. So okay, exactly. So that's what a planetesimal is. You said they formed further in or closer into the sun than they are today. So to give us a sense of scale, so the Earth is about 150 million kilometers from the sun. So that's what we call one astronomical unit. Jupiter's about five times that. So what's that? Jupiter's about 800 million kilometers from the sun or thereabouts. And then Saturn's about double that, and Uranus double that, and Neptune double that. And you easily get to tens of billions of kilometers from the sun. And out there, tens of billions of kilometers, tens of times further from the sun than the Earth is, and the terrestrial planets that we know. You mentioned these were icy objects. The solar system is a different kind of place out there in terms of the material they're made of. Why is that? Why is it so different way out there than it is close into the sun?
By forming further out, these sort of more volatile materials, water ice is the big one, but then there'd also be stuff like methane and ammonia-based compounds and stuff. They're able to freeze out and not be irradiated and just go away as a gas. So those objects, if they've formed far enough out and they stay far enough out, they never really lose those volatiles. It's only whenever they evolve eventually into the inner solar system that they get heated up enough that they start to lose these icy volatile materials.
So those objects that do stay out there, that do stay out in the Kuiper Belt, you mentioned it's got this kind of structure of all the different bits that form there and how they got scattered there and put there by the interactions with the outer planets. Can you say a little bit about that substructure? What are the main components of the Kuiper Belt now?
It's usually it's funny because in the papers you see it as like a flow chart, how to classify these objects into different bins. So usually one of the first things you're checking for is resonant orbits. So if a object is in resonance with generally Neptune, because Neptune's the closest giant planet in that region, these objects are held in a sort of resonant behavior with Neptune. They go into the resonant group. Then you get scattered objects. So scattered objects can cover like a wide range of the parameter space, but they're essentially objects that at their perihelion or the nearest point of their orbit to the sun, they are near Neptune's orbit. That means that they can interact and scatter directly off Neptune. So they're evolving directly under the influence of Neptune, but they're not in a resonance. And then the sort of main group after those other ones is the classicals. So the classicals are objects that aren't in resonance and they're not scattering. They're just sort of on relatively circular, relatively uninclined, relatively flat orbits. But the classicals themselves can be divided further down into hot classicals and cold classicals. And that's just sort of an arbitrary cut where the hot classicals are slightly more eccentric. Their orbits are slightly less circular and their orbits are slightly more inclined than the cold classicals. But that's the thing, that's what makes the cold classicals, for me at least, particularly interesting, because these are objects that, as we mentioned, they are quite icy and volatile rich. They haven't been heated much since they've been formed, so their material is pretty primordial, as close to primordial as we're probably going to get. But then their dynamical orbits, they're very flat, they're very circular. These orbits haven't been changed very much since, they haven't been excited very much by the influence of the larger planets. So it makes these objects sort of relatively untouched and like a really pristine sample to study for looking at the early days of the solar system.
And so this hot and cold classical is not to do with temperatures, surface temperature of the objects at all. It's just because of it's to do with the energy in their orbit effectively, or how much energy input, if you like, has gone in there, how much they've been stirred up by other stuff. So it's you mentioned dynamical, how things are moving. So it's that kind of hot and cold rather than
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, yeah, sorry. It's like analogous to, you know, excitation of molecules in a gas. A hot gas is fast-moving particles. A cold gas is slow-moving particles. It's exactly that.
So these cold classical objects, as you say, are the really, for you, the really interesting ones, the ones that are pristine, that haven't been touched by Neptune or any other giant planets. Does that mean they formed where they are, or did they still gradually migrate out, do we think?
Well, yeah, so it's this is where the sort of planetary migration models we talked about earlier, like the NICE model, come in. One of the constraints of the NICE model is that Neptune started at about 20 AU and then underwent some instabilities, but then what it did is it gently migrated, well, relatively smoothly migrated outwards to its current orbit at about 30 AU. And the way it did that was it essentially was interacting with this surrounding disk of planetesimals, and it would essentially take planetesimals, throw them into the inner solar system, and that would throw Neptune out just a tiny bit. So it underwent this, like, over the course of, you know, millions of years, and a relatively smooth outward migration using that mechanism. But basically, that means that whenever it reaches its current orbit of about 30 AU, it has to have run out of material. Because if there was a continuous disk, thick disk of planetesimals, it would have kept throwing things in and throwing itself out. So because of that, there's it's sort of strong evidence that the main planetesimal disk really sort of had a steep cutoff at about 30 AU. But that's not to say that like a smaller, less dense population of planetesimals couldn't have formed further out where the cold classicals are currently residing at about 40 to 50 AU or so. But that's the thing, the cold classicals are probably a combination of, well, the classicals in general, including the cold classicals, are a combination of things that could have formed at that those extreme distances and things that were gently pushed out by the influence of Neptune as it went on its migration outwards.
So we're probably looking at the tail end of that distribution, the very outer edges of what formed in the solar system. Okay, let's come on to the kind of things we've seen. So actually, for now at least, we may come back to it, but we'll skip over Pluto, which is the thing that New Horizons visited back in 2015, because that's a big icy object, very much different from a planetesimal. It's formed, it's made thousands of kilometers in diameter. It is this dwarf planet, and there's a few others out there as well that are similar sizes, that, you know, certainly a good few hundred or thousands of kilometers across, and there are undoubtedly a good number that we haven't found yet because they're so far out and hard to see. But Pluto's second object that it visited back in at the start of 2019, so over 2.5 years ago now, was this object we now call Arrokoth, which had this weird, it was kind of, well, it looked in the photos like a snowman shape, but I think it was actually a flattened snowman shape, wasn't it? It was like two pancakes stuck together kind of thing. Is that a fair description of what it, if you took a snowman, tipped it over and sat on it kind of shape, is that a fair description?
Yeah, I think so. And like that was quite interesting, because it is whenever you see the images, you know, whenever you Google them or whatever, you see these like what looks like two perfect spheres, and then as they got more data downloaded, then they were able to sort of like, you know, effectively take that 3D shape model and tilt it, and then you can see, oh, actually at least one of those is very, very flat, which like is super interesting. You know, how does that form? How do those two objects come together? You know, it's very intriguing.
And the reason for that is that if you get things at the size of planets, then gravity tends to compress them into spherical shapes. This is why the planets that we see and the bigger asteroids and moons and so on are all roughly spherical. But smaller objects than that, there's not enough strength of gravity to make them just their own gravity fall them into spheres. But things do tend to be relatively round in shape. So how do you get a flattened pancake-sized object in the first place? Forget the fact that it's these two lobes. How do you get one flattened pancake object?
Yeah, well, it sort of depends, because like in the asteroid belt, for example, there are images of, they're not quite fully flat as a pancake, but you do get these asteroids that evolve with these bulges along the equator. And what that's happening is it's actually, these are rubble pile asteroids, they're very loosely held together, and they've been spinning relatively close to the rate at which they would just tear themselves apart. So that's causing these this bulging around the equator. But this looks very different. The asteroids, those are rubble piles, they have very low internal strength. Whereas these outer solar system objects, they've not been collisionally evolved very strongly. There's very little evidence for major collisions occurring in the object Arakov. If there was a big collision, it wouldn't be a contact binary, essentially. So it's very interesting, because it seems like this is more to do with how it formed originally, rather than being processed and evolving into that shape afterwards. And it's like it's interesting to look at the detailed images of these objects, and they've got some sort of rough geological maps as well. And there's tentative hints of like large building blocks making up this disk, this sort of pancake-like disk. So I think it's like it's very much a product of how it formed, made up of these like smaller components that have come together to in this sort of disc-like shape.
And as you say, you mentioned this idea of a contact binary. So that's if these two objects that are just, it's almost like they're just touched and stuck together, gently at some point.
Yeah. So whenever you look at an image of Arakoth, you see two lobes and they're joined by a narrow neck. And yeah, it's exactly, these things must have come together very, very gently. Otherwise, they would have sort of mushed together more and formed a more like lumpy object. But there's that distinct sort of neck between the lobes.
Well, presumably, if it had been fast enough, they could have just blown each other to smithereens, you know, just fragmented into lots of tiny pieces. Or would that have then probably just compressed back down again and collapsed back down to a sphere? It had been...
Oh yeah, it totally depends on the relative velocity of that collision. If it's high enough, it'll just blow apart and be scattered. But if it's a gentle contact binary, and then if it's in between, there'll probably be a bit of material ejected, a bit of reconstruction and reaccumulation after the fragments have settled down.
And now, it's dangerous to do too much with one object because it's one out of... billions that are out there in the outer solar system. But new data from New Horizons, new images that were taken a few years ago, I think, have two other objects that are also close to its path through the outer solar system, have shown that these two at least, or two of the three that it looked at, are also binary objects. They're actually two objects going around each other. So they're not what we call a contact binary, not two objects touching, but they are... each of these is made of two smaller objects going round each other. I mean, if people want to look up their phone numbers, 2011 JY31 and 2014 OS393, the names are probably not really that important. But these are what's the importance of then finding more binary objects? What can we do with that data? Because three is also not a very big number out of billions, right?
Well, yeah, but it's. It's interesting because like there's a lot of predictions for a very high binary fraction especially in the cold classical region in particular. And we've inferred that through a lot of different things where, for example, if you look at the light curve of an object, if you like point the telescope at an object for a period of time and see how its brightness changes, there's distinctive signatures in that light curve that can tell you, oh, this thing is probably, this could be like a very tight or contact binary. Essentially, if the amplitude of that light curve changes really rapidly, sort of if you imagine the contact binary is like a big long elongated shape as a first approximation, as that the aspect of that ellipse changes, you know, you'll go from very bright whenever it's side on to very dim whenever it's like in line with you. So there's been a lot of light curve studies that show like, oh, there's hints of these binaries, but that's the thing, they're so far away that whenever you try to image the two objects separately, there's no way to do it. They're just too far away, and the components are too close together to resolve this. So this is what has made this announcement of these objects really interesting, is because New Horizons is going through the Kuiper Belt, and it's able to turn around and image these objects from at a very high resolution and resolve these things that we couldn't possibly resolve from the ground or even from like the Hubble Space Telescope. Essentially there was these hints that there should be a high binary fraction, and it's really cool to see this confirmed with a couple of objects.
Mm. So it did observe a third one that wasn't, it didn't see evidence that was a binary object, but that was one of these other bits of the population of the Kuiper Belt, right? That was from the scattered disk that had been flung outwards. So you said that high binaries in that cold classical region where these other two objects are from, and then maybe not in things like the scattered disk. Is that one of the ideas?
Well, yeah. So the consensus for the sort of fraction of binary objects amongst these populations is like order of, you know, 30% binaries in the cold classicals, whereas it drops to about 10% for the other populations, such as like the hot classicals and the scattered disk objects. And the interesting thing it says about that is that the binary objects, if they're in very excited dynamical orbits where, you know, the scattered disk objects are interacting quite closely with Neptune, those binaries are easily torn apart and destroyed. So it says a lot about the cold classicals. That's again another piece of evidence that the cold classicals haven't really been touched that much since the planetesimals themselves formed, because these binaries are still there and they still exist.
And they're relatively fragile, so too much interference would have, as you say, would have disrupted them. Fascinating. Now, one of the other things is that with these binary objects, because you have two objects going around each other, you get other little snippets of information, don't you?
Basically, binaries are very important because short of doing a space mission, it's the only way to accurately measure the mass of planetesimals, small bodies. Because essentially what you can do is you can observe the satellite, the secondary going around the primary, measure the period, and from Kepler's third law, then that's how you get the mass of the system. And that's super valuable, because especially whenever it's combined with an accurate size of the objects, you can use that mass and that size to work out a volume and a density, basically. So then if you observe a binary embedded within a certain population of objects and you get a density, that could be an indicator of the density of that entire population. And that density tells you a lot about its composition and possibly even its internal structure. So very valuable bits of information to be found from binaries.
So this leads to the idea that this cold classical belt is this pristine, or this is further evidence that it's this pristine population. What now with these objects? Do we go and try and find more of these? I mean, New Horizons, I guess, I think in principle it could visit maybe one more object if there was something in close enough to its current path. Would that be something that people like yourselves would be in favour of?
Oh yeah, no, totally. The more we get, the merrier, sort of thing. And yeah, I think I was watching the press release for these two objects, and yeah, they were saying that they are still looking out for additional flyby targets to hopefully maybe use a little bit of extra fuel to like zip past and get some more close-up images of these things, because that's the thing, at the end of the day, these objects are so far away that the only way we're going to get a detailed look at them is with these flybys. So for example, the really cool thing about Arakoth is that another tool, in addition to light curves, at like getting a hint of if an object might be a close binary or a contact binary, are stellar occultations. So I remember being at conferences before the flyby occurred, and Mark Buey et al, they were looking at, they had this big campaign to do stellar occultations of Arakoth. And essentially what they had to do is send, you know, astronomers in trucks like all over the world to use, set up these mobile telescopes and then point at a star. And then as Arakoth moved in front of the star, it would occult the star, it would block out the light. So from the ground, you'd just see this star blip out for a little bit. But whenever you put together the timings of whenever the star went off and the star came back on, and combine that with lots of different measurements or chords from all across the globe, you actually trace out the shadow of Arakoth on the Earth. And the really cool thing about that was, is that if it was just a single blob, you just see a sort of outline of blobs amongst these occultations, whereas the data that was presented was, this looks like you know, two circles together. And at that stage, we didn't know enough to say, like, is it a separated binary that, like, it just happens to be aligned in such a way that it looks like two circles touching, or is it genuinely two circles touching, or is it something more unusual? The only way that that was able to be confirmed for certain was sending New Horizons out there. So, like, getting it to take more images of these object surfaces would be excellent.
Well, I mean, fingers crossed there's another object that can fly by and we can get more information on these pristine bits of the solar system. We'll come in now to the inner solar system, or at least further in towards the inner solar system, and to this mission that launched on the 16th of October. It's called Lucy, which is, I guess, a fairly unusual name for a space mission. It's named after the hominid fossil dubbed Lucy that was discovered back in 1970s, that's because Lucy is going to look not unlike some of those objects in the Kuiper Belt, at pristine objects here near the inner solar system. It's going to fly by an asteroid in the asteroid belt called Donald Johansson, which is named after one of the co-discoverers of that Lucy hominid back in the 1970s, which is a nice little link. And then it's going to go out to look at some objects called Trojan asteroids. What's a Trojan asteroid?
A Trojan asteroid is an object that is in one-to-one resonance with a planet. So in the case of the Jupiter Trojans, for every one orbit that Jupiter makes around the sun, this object also makes one orbit around the sun. And generally, they'll be found in two clusters, sort of. If you're looking top down on a picture of the orbit of Jupiter, sort of 60 degrees ahead of Jupiter, the leading group, and then 60 degrees behind Jupiter, the trailing group. And essentially, like, it's one of those sort of undergrad physics problems, like, where along the orbit is the force from the sun equal to the force from Jupiter? That's those Lagrange points, the leading and trailing groups. So basically, they precede and follow Jupiter as it goes around its orbit.
And so it's just this gravitational sweet spot, if you like, where they're just held there. And because it is this gravitational sweet spot, it's relatively hard for them to escape. We get Trojan asteroids of the Earth, but they tend to sit there for a little bit and then fly off again because the Earth isn't very massive. Jupiter's, you know, getting on for 400 times the mass of the Earth. It's obviously the most massive planet. It's got a pretty big gravitational well, and therefore a pretty strong Trojan asteroid sweet spot, if you like, at those points. Why are Trojan asteroids that are sort of trapped in these sweet spots, why are they particularly interesting?
Those leading and trailing groups, they are relatively stable, but they are easily, like, it is relatively easy to fall out of them if the planet itself moves. For example, if you're in the sweet spot and the planet moves, under migration, then maybe you're not in the sweet spot. You've been lost. You've been stranded. So that's the thing. If these planets migrated, you know, the objects that we find now in their Trojan locations may not necessarily be the ones that formed there. And the Trojans themselves are particularly interesting because they have sort of properties that are more akin to outer solar system planetesimals in the Kuiper belt that we were talking about before. So for example, they have generally like quite low albedo, very low reflectivity. So these things are like extremely dark. So they're some of the darkest objects in the solar system. They have surfaces that are sort of have colors that are more similar to the very red outer solar system objects. And whenever you can measure like the density of some of these objects, and they have quite low densities compared to the higher density rocky asteroids. Low density is more similar to icy, volatile-rich outer solar system objects.
In some ways, these are interlopers. They're these outer solar system objects that are closer than they perhaps should be, all things being equal, if Jupiter weren't there. And that means that if they're closer, they're a little bit easier to get to. Not particularly easy to get to, because it still takes years for these things to get there. Lucy, the spacecraft, is going to do a couple of flybys of the Earth and not get out there until 2027. The other nice thing is that because there's these two clusters, they're relatively close together. So Lucy can actually get a few in one go, quite a few in one go, can't it?
Well, yeah, like I've been looking up the sort of orbital maneuvers that they've planned, and it's this beautiful, like almost butterfly-like diagram, where basically Lucy is going to go out. It's going to go to the leading cloud of Trojans first. It's going to hit a whole bunch of those with a bunch of flybys, but then it's going to come back, gravity assist around the Earth, and then go to the trailing group. And then if you recall how I described the diagram, that's like 60 degrees ahead of Jupiter and 60 degrees behind. It's just going to go back and forth like that. And I think it's a 12-year mission duration to see these, I think it's like five Trojan targets altogether, four in the leading cloud and one in the trailing cloud. But I think in principle, it can keep doing that maneuver in between. I think there are plans possibly of it continuing on, but the nominal mission is for those five.
And then on the way out, it's going to visit this Donald Johansson asteroid. That's in some senses, that sounds relatively dull. It's just an asteroid. It's not an exciting sort of interloper that's come in too close. It's not been trapped by Jupiter's gravitational pull. But I guess, you know, we don't have many flybys of asteroids. So is it a case of any flyby of any asteroid is going to release invaluable information about these objects, I guess?
There have only been, you know, I don't know the number off my top of my head, maybe like tens of flybys before, possibly. They're very hard to do, and but the science that we get out of it is invaluable, because you get a detailed look at the shape of this object. You can get a detailed constraint of its size and therefore its volume. From a flyby, you can like look at its surface geology, and that tells you how the surface has been processed by, you know, solar radiation or collisions and impacts. And then I believe as well, Lucy has the capabilities of measuring the mass of an asteroid during the flyby. It can use its radio science instrument to do some fancy maths to see how much it's deflected by, I think, to determine the mass of the object it's flown by.
So we'll get lots of information on this asteroid that we simply can't get from Earth from flying by. And then when it gets out to the Trojans, it'll look at these interesting objects and see how unusual these objects are. I mean, presumably there's a lot of variation within the Trojan group as well.
We mentioned that there have been other flybys of asteroids and stuff. We have pictures of asteroids, but the Trojans have never been visited before. So it's really important to go and like see them in person, so to say. But that's the thing. There are different types of Trojans, and they so far have been really just studied and identified from their photometry, like the properties of how their light looks in different wavelengths and stuff like that. So it'll be really important to sort of get there, get close, get like detailed spectroscopic measurements and stuff like that, and then we can have like an actual, you know, we've looked at this object from the ground, this is what its photometry tells us, this is exactly what's on the surface and what the surface looks like. So, you know, we then have that like actual example that we can then hopefully learn a lot more about the whole population and the subpopulations within.
It's going to be fascinating to visit these objects, as you say, that are sort of interlopers and left over from the or possibly left over from the outer solar system that got captured by Jupiter. One interesting thing about Donald Johansson, the asteroid, not the scientist, is that, although I'm sure he's a fascinating person as well, so it's this small object that's a few kilometres across, and it's part of another family of asteroids. So it's part of a group. Now, I'm not 100% on the pronunciation, but Erigone, that family of asteroids, because there's a larger object, Erigone, whichever, I apologise for the pronunciation if either of those is wrong. One of them certainly is. This is a chunk of, and that's actually surprisingly common, isn't it, to find families of asteroids that are chunks of other asteroids.
Yeah. The collisional families are a whole like another thing that tells us a whole lot about the conditions in like the asteroid belt, for example. So yeah, you're totally correct. A collisional family is usually believed to be like a large collision occurs and a whole swarm of objects are produced, and they sort of spread out over time. But whenever we look at their orbital elements and how their orbital elements have changed under the influence of the planets, we can like see that these clusters appear, and that cluster is, you know, a family with a common origin. And then because they all came from the same object, you know, they generally have similar physical properties, you know, similar surface colors and stuff like that. And then those collisions is also how, from the asteroid belt at least, you know, those fragments then are fed into these resonances with Jupiter that throw them towards the Earth. And then that's how we get our meteors and hopefully meteorites falling on the ground that we can collect and analyze and get a sample of those objects.
And as you say, that's another way of then getting kind of ground truth, if you like, of having these observations from telescopes on the Earth, and then having an actual observation from up close, and then be able to tie them together, which gives us more confidence for future observations from the Earth. And that's something that now I know you're involved in, isn't it? The future observations from here on Earth, where we don't have to design spacecraft over decades to go flying for years and years through the solar system, to try and observe these things from down here on the ground. What's your plans for those kind of observations in the next few years?
Exactly. I've been working recently on using sort of like wide field surveys that scan the sky every night and search for moving objects, and they can associate those photometric measurements and those detections with known objects or discover new objects, for example. But that's saying that they're generating these massive, massive data sets. So currently I've been working with the ATLAS survey, which is a telescope survey based out of Hawaii, and it's two telescopes. Yeah, scans the sky every night. Their main intention is to search for potentially hazardous asteroids. So I'm helping save the Earth and stuff like that. But they've built up this massive like body of observations over the course of the many years that the survey has been running. And you can use those observations taken in different filters and at different like viewing geometries of the asteroids to see how their brightnesses are changing, to see how see what their surface colors are. And the cool thing about that is that, you know, you can use that to look at the properties of hundreds of thousands of asteroids. Whereas with a flyby, you're only looking at one usually. The downside is that the analysis that I'm doing is very broad stroke. It's more getting the statistics of a whole population rather than getting like an actual detailed look at a particular object. And it is sort of limited by the disadvantages where, like, for example, the surface properties of an asteroid, they're a function of like the composition, what it's actually made of, but also the surface properties in terms of like, is it fine-grained? Is it coarse-grained? Are there big boulders? Stuff like that. You know, it's there's a lot of information entangled in these large sort of photometric surveys.
But as we've seen, then knowing more about these objects and finding out more about them can lead to plans to go and visit them in the future with future missions. So who knows? Fingers crossed that there's a lot more information comes out and that we get fascinating views from Lucy of these Trojan asteroids and, of course, the asteroid Donald Johansson when it flies by. I think that's 2025 it's planned, so perhaps won't hold my breath for quite that long. But we should get some stunning views as we normally get of these I was going to say unique. I guess there's a lot of these things out there, but very interesting objects to go and study and learn more about the formation of the solar system. So Dr. James Robinson from the University of Edinburgh, thanks very much.
Yep, thank you very much, Chris.
That's it for this month. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk, or you can find us on Spotify. Just search for Pythagorean Astronomy. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.